G'day, welcome back to English History Fact and Fiction, episode the 315th, while Paul in trouble. My name's Dick Newman. It's been a little while since the last episode, sorry about that. Just to explain to you, 2 months ago today, where I am in space-time, I was in the hospital. They were sticking a stent in my heart. Marvellous thing. Now, it takes a couple of days to get over that, but once over it, wow, you feel great. Got all this energy. So I started going on to cardiac rehab, where they soon sent me home. Yeah, I got sacked because I was still getting chest pain. So they said, you have to go home, you have to do nothing. I said, well, I want to do stuff. I feel great. And they said, you can't. You need to get your cardiologist to tick off on it. Now, the cardiologist had just gone on bloody holiday, hadn't he? So, long story short, I sat around on my ass doing nothing. Then 2 weeks ago, where I am in space-time, I saw my cardiologist. He said, look, that's okay. That's okay. You can manage it with the little spray stuff. They call it a gin and tonic or something like that. So I've got the little spray stuff, and the next day it was raining, so I thought, no exercise. But I had a bloody stroke. You wouldn't believe it. I had a bloody stroke 2 weeks ago today. So I ended up back in hospital. I couldn't do anything. Couldn't sit, couldn't stand, couldn't do a cracker. But amazingly, they've got me up and running around. So this episode was recorded earlier, and all I've got to do is the bit of historical fiction at the end, and it's ready for your ears. So, enough about me. Let's get on with it. And that their jaunty little bit of music was, of course, Lady Mary Montagu's Reel, the first track, off the 12 Country Dancers album by Ignatius Sancho, who is being born somewhere around now in podcast years. Now, I might just point out, Lady Mary Montagu is not Lady Mary Wortley Montagu. That's why the other one's called Wortley in there in the middle, because we need to tell the difference. But back to Ignatius. Now, this little piece of music was just so jaunty, was it not? It's just a real piece of fun, perhaps not inspired by the guy's birth. You see, Ignatius is being born somewhere around now on a slave ship somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean. Is it worse? Yes. It's worse because he is a black baby. Oh, dear. Well, at least he's with his mum and dad, and they'll land in New Granada, where mum and dad can be worked to death within about 2 years. Two-year-old Ignatius will not be sold. This toddler will luck out by being taken to Britain and given to three sisters in Greenwich. It's not all good luck, because they're just going to treat him like a servant. That is, poorly. Ignatius will run away, aged 18, all the way to John Montagu, who married John and Sarah Churchill's daughter Mary, making her Lady Mary Montagu. Why ever did Ignatius run all the way to John Montagu, the Duke of Montagu? Well, believe it or not, this guy was doing good things. Yeah, really, he was doing good stuff. And Ignatius will not be the only guy with black skin to do well under John. So let's leave Ignatius now to learn how to read and write and eventually compose music like that stuff we just heard. Yeah, just a little bit more there from Ignatius. Now, last week we had a look at the state of the church not going well for them. The government is trying to really get them under the thumb. Do your magic show on Sunday, boys, and keep out of politics. We also had a look at Walpole coming into some new taxation kind of regime. He'd done quite well with the taxation stuff. He's managed to probably halve the land tax by introducing indirect taxes, and those things kind of went okay for him, so he's decided to do some more. Bit of a dick move, really, because he's in an election year, so he's not going to find it's going too well for him. He did have a look at the Scotties, and at this time thought, yeah, perhaps I'm not going to stir them up with any sort of salt tax. So the Scotties got to be exempt. Well, that kind of allowed us to then call bullshit on his argument that the salt tax was hardly felt by anyone. If it was hardly felt by anyone, then why exempt the Scotties? Oh, just your standard compassion, says Walpole. But he hasn't got any bloody compassion, we all know that. Has he stirred up a hornet's nest here? Yes, say the opposition, what about a bit of compassion for the English poor people? The debate might have got out of hand with it being about a general excise that hasn't actually happened, but nobody's interested in fair play in politics. The salt tax didn't actually bring in that much revenue, so from our view in the 21st century, it does look like it was more about the jobs to be handing out. Walpole will now be hammered as a big taxer of the people. It's worse, of course, with corruption being exposed. Okay, we all say, look, corruption's pretty standard, but this is at a time when we're getting a bit silly over fears of excises that haven't actually happened, and fears that the government is coming for our money. And we get corruption after corruption cases being exposed, and not all corruption is equal in the eyes of the mob. Some of it is particularly bad. So, James Radcliffe, Earl of Derwinter, and Jacobite had been done at the Battle of Preston. That got his head off. But what about his lands? Well, we look after those lands for his dear little lad, for when that dear little lad comes of age. The guy we got to look after the land was Dennis Bond, MP for Poole. Yes, the name's Bond, Dennis Bond. Dennis gets the nice title Commissioner to look after those lands, and he gets a salary of £1,000 a year, tax-free. What we expect is that, in exchange for giving him that rather bloody decent salary, that commissioners will actually do the right thing. So, will Dennis Bond do the right thing? Not bloody likely. Bond and another MP will concentrate their efforts on part of the estate that had been confiscated and could be sold. They will organise an auction, but invite one bidder only, a certain guy known as a rogue. So in comes our rogue, and oddly enough, he manages to win that election. Yeah, given that he's the only guy, it wasn't too hard, was it? He got that bit of land for £1,000, and then they managed to transfer a bit of extra land to him at the same time. That could be done by having three commissioners in total signing off on a document. No problem, Sir John Isles, Commissioner, signed a blank document for them. They next organised the kiddies' annuity to be transferred to themselves, and finally the balance of the estate worth £9,000. Here, they got that too. So they've got the lot. There you go. And the kiddie had been sickly and died. That prompted an inquiry, and the whole sorry story came out. Bond and his accomplice were expelled from the House of Commons. Yeah, that was their punishment. But if you're a common smelly, steal a loaf of bread, mate, we might hang you. Isles was under his attack for his part in the thing, but he was one of those who had the job of running the South Sea Company after the crisis. Also, he was a firm Walpolean. He then said, it was a great weight of the business of the South Sea Company that was to blame. And so now you all know that, I expect you to apologise to me. Oh, that will be a no, and all of a sudden we're thinking about poking around the South Sea Company for naughtiness again. All the attacks on Isles was under parliamentary privilege, so Isles will be saying, say that outside Parliament, causing the Speaker to calm all the boys down. To sort it out, Isles will be found guilty of an irregularity in respect to his signing off the blank document, and will get away with a reprimand. Here's the words. Happy for you, sir, it appears to the House to have been a matter rather of evil example than evil intention, for which reasons the resolution of the House on this occasion have a mixture of justice and mercy. Mercy, all right, my dear listener, you and I would have gotten a slammer for sure and be lucky to have gotten out of it alive. We get the charitable company going belly up with Chief Villain, George Robinson MP, just vanishing from the record, owing the corporation £46,000, just as its agent, let alone what he embezzled. Easy work, as the other directors were crooked too. Who cares about them either? But there's a big fish in there. Sir Robert Sutton, who had kicked off as a nobody, got a deacon gig, then an ambassador's chaplain, which led to a diplomatic and commercial career. Got the ambassador's job at Constantinople, became an agent of the Levant Company, got involved in treaty negotiations, then ambassador in Paris. Married Sunderland's widow and became MP for Nottinghamshire. Shit, he's doing all right, isn't he? He's doing very bloody well. He is what you call nouveau riche. Yeah, new money. But Walpole has no prejudice except with losers. And crikey, this guy is not a loser. Walpole will sort out a night at the bathroom. Now, right now, Sir Robert has to try and defend the charitable company to Parliament. Bad news. Robinson's theft had drawn a committee of inquiry generally. Oh dear, we don't like those. Fortunately for Sir Robert Sutton, he was not involved in the fraud of George Robinson. Unfortunately for Robert Sutton, the inquiry chanced upon unrelated naughtiness that he'd been into. He's given false evidence and issued notes after promising he would stop issuing notes, and he's gotten into insider trading. All this stuff is going down at a time when a bit of petty theft by a common smelly is leading to the noose, my dear listener. That's what's going on. The opposition can now smell fear in the government ranks. Never let a lion or the opposition smell your fear, my dear listener. Both will lead to an attack. Attack comes in. The opposition wants Sutton, and here's Walpole to defend. And look, apart from his own naughtiness, Sutton was on the board while Robinson was repeatedly knocking off cash. Big cash. That's gross incompetence. And that will give Walpole his defence. Ah, look, this guy's a dickhead who lost out through those thefts. Sure, he's terribly negligent, bit of a dickhead, but he's got a good character and took no part in the great big fraud. Yes, okay, my dear listener, I agree with you. It is a crap defence. But these things can work if you have the numbers in Parliament. Not good enough, though, for Sir John Barnard, who usually does the speaking on behalf of small businessmen in London. The charges against Sutton are not harsh enough. Sutton was a very naughty boy. But right now, Sutton, we don't have company law yet. The House will rise with the matter outstanding. Those involved are told not to leave the country or transfer their assets to someone else for safekeeping. Good tactic. Surely other stuff will happen during the break to take everyone's mind off this case. In fact, no. Parliament resumes, and here's Pulteney's best boy, and he's done his homework. Got himself a confession from Thompson, one of those in the spotlight for naughtiness. That will lead to a motion that Sutton is guilty of many notorious breaches of trust and many indirect and fraudulent practices. Yeah, sounds pretty fair. But if that gets up, then Sutton will be out of a job for life. No working for the government or any corporation. So yeah, that won't happen. 148 to 89 will see him get a reprimand for neglect of duties. And 50 MPs will stage a walkout in disgust. Yeah. Yeah, that's always nice to see, isn't it? MPs walking out in disgust. Does anything ever change? No. Sutton will be booted out of Parliament, but he'll be back next election. There you go. As for the charitable company, well, it was set up to help the poor, but that simply didn't happen. The papers will be full of these guys and their rather poor attitudes towards the poor. And so, having started the year in perhaps an unbeatable position electorally, Walpole is now just copping criticism. He is plotting people for MP seats right now, and the papers seem to not only know it, they know who he's putting where. In those moves, there's going to be a seat for his brother Horatio and one for his not terribly bright son. So we've got the nepotism going on. Now our genius can get going on more excise duties. He knows this is a winner, so he'll approach the task without his usual big deal parliamentary manoeuvrings. The opposition, though, has got wind that this is coming, and they are prepared. They will send Walpole a big fat message as speaker after speaker rises to talk about something like, "You better not be thinking about any new taxes, mate." Or they'll say, traders in England will be off due to all these new trade taxes. Or they'll say, every session of Parliament sees some new villainy or roguery being introduced. Yeah, look, nothing's actually been introduced or presented, but the opposition are into it already. Worse for Walpole, if he has his eyes and ears open, is Pulteney basically saying, bring it on, Wally. Oh, no, you can't bring it on, can you? Because it's a half-baked idea and you're working your dinger off to amend the thing. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when the opposition are laughing and teasing you, you better be on your guard. But Walpole is not rushing that bill in, so there's time for speculation in the House, and when we can speculate, we can bag it. Is it to be your general excise? Not likely. The gentleman, that is Walpole, knows that would be too much at once, so I suppose he means to single out certain items to hunt down first. Walpole, though, is saying, look, there's nothing much to see here. What I'm doing is I'm looking to combat fraud, particularly in the wine and tobacco trades. Now, opposition wine merchants and tobacconists can jump up and speak about, there's nothing bloody well wrong with their particular trade. Look at something else, mate. The main speaker there was a Whig. Oh, one of his own. So beware, Walpole, when your own team is speaking against you. The opposition are feeling rather pleased with themselves, so they'll start taking the initiative on other items of government business. What about the standing army, Walpole? That's not Whig policy. Is that standing army there to help you be a big brave boy to raise taxes on poor honest traders? And what's this? It's a petition from the American colony of Rhode Island against new sugar duties, which the government has said it won't hear. Pulteney will say, no wonder they petitioned. It's a frightful state of affairs with taxes, taxes and more taxes. Is the government refusing the petition to be a precedent where the government will receive no petitions against their new schemes? Oh yes, refusing petitions is not good form. And besides, the opposition have their mates all ready to bombard Parliament with petitions. Walpole, loyal newspapers are saying there was a bit of ruckus recently, but everything's going terribly well now. All right. Everyone's listening to the voice of reason. Yeah, I don't think so. The action is not contained to Parliament. The City of London back then was filled with merchants who we might call small and medium-sized. Meetings of merchants will be called, and from these come gangs of lobbyists getting into MPs to let them know that merchants find the idea of more excise to be bad. Oh, well, who knew that, yeah. Public order might be starting to suffer. Bring on the JPs, the constables, and the civil magistrates to keep the peace. The Royal Guards are on DEFCON 3, ready to march at a moment's notice. And I remind you, my dear listener, no bill's actually been presented. Oh, okay, finally, Walpole reckons he's got his ducks in a row, so it'll be the announcement to the House. It's wine and tobacco only that he's looking at, and it's about too much lost revenue. Fraud's the problem. Fraud's a big problem, but right now, though, we're just looking at tobacco and not wine. And Walpole has kicked off something that will last for ages and ages and ages and ages and ages. When I was a young kiddie selling newspapers at the Highbay Hotel, every time the government brought down their budget, the headline would say, beer up, fags up. Yeah, booze and fags. Governments see these vices as easy pickings to get cash out of us. So, dickheads, legalise the sex trade and legalise the happy herb and make more money while saving on the expense of having so many people in the slammer. Bobby Sue took the money and run. Good, good, good. Go on, take the money and run. Go on, take the money and run. Yeah, tax officers all over the world love that song by the Steve Miller Band, Take the Money and Run, which is what they do. Now, the idea with this one is that beer and fags are luxury goods. If we keep away from a salt tax and just hit the luxury stuff, then Walpole reckons he'll get away with it. All you need to do is just have one day a week off the beer and fags, and the net result to your wallet is, well, you'll be ahead. Beer and fags are not essential to maintaining human life. But what of Walpole's speech as reported in the newspapers? We have lately been told that Parliament does not sit to please merchants, as they are really a band of sturdy beggars who enrich themselves with the plunder of the nation. Oh, ouch. Bagging merchants might not be that smart. But this is Walpole, the Master of Parliament, and he has facts and figures. Stuff about guys who've been caught out doing naughty things to avoid excise. Here's one for you. You import tobacco and you pay your excise, all nice and legal like. If some of that tobacco you've imported is to then go out to another country, you claim your import excise back when exporting. Yeah, I know, seems like a bit overly complicated, but that's the system. So our merchant gets his cases of tobacco in, unpacks them, and then fills some of them back up with straw, put a few tobacco leaves on top, and then you send it off somewhere to get your excise back. Walpole is great when it comes to talking about money. He is reasonable and can get his message across. In a nice, calm manner, he will then tackle the general excise idea. This was just one of many slanders that people have hit me with. I do most unequivocally assert that no such scheme ever entered my head, or for what I know, into the head of any man I am acquainted with. Of course it didn't, because all plans for the benefit of the government must be just and practical. A general excise would be neither. It would be a crime for me to propose, a crime for you to accept, and the only thing that the House can do for the people is to reject the idea. What a lovely lie, my dear listener. Our very own John Howard was elected on a promise of no goods and services tax, and then he brought it in straight after he got elected. There you go. A goods and services tax might be on Walpole's mind. The government is losing revenue on the current system. If we change that from a duty on the import of goods to a duty on the consumption of goods, then everybody will be happy. No, I know, my dear listener, not everyone will be happy, but let's press on. So Walpole is proposing a small reduction in the import tax rate by switching the collection point from the docks to the warehouses. So that small reduction in rate would result in actually an increase in revenue because we cut out the fraud. Shouldn't the consumer be happy with this? The expectation of governments is always that we will be pleased with their clever closing down of tax avoidance. But no, we ordinary people are not happy with it because no matter what the government does, the net result is always increased cost to the end consumer. That is us, because merchants pass all this stuff along. Right now, for Walpole, the opposition has had time to get themselves into a totally positive position to bag whatever Walpole did. Walpole should have won the election and then started doing his messing around with taxes, but he was all too full of himself and his strong position. He's losing support over this, but of course, he's also gaining some support from those who can actually see the rationale of his proposals. And hey, look, if you're a fan of government, then it is a good idea what he's proposing. Shall we vote? 249 in favour, 189 against. So, a win. And really, with the opposition having been full on, that was a reasonable result for Walpole. There will be a newspaper that are having a go at little Georgie Handel. He's having a bit of an up and down time at the moment. But really, what it is, it's their trickery thingy. They're actually having a go at Walpole. They just weren't going to put Walpole's name in there, so they put Handel in instead. The rise and progress of Mr. Handel's powers and fortunes are too well known to relate. No music but his own was to be allowed, though everybody was weary of it, and he had the insolence to assert that there was no composer in England but himself. No voices nor instruments were admitted but such as flattered his ears, and the best hands were kept out of the orchestras in favour of the most wretched scrapers. He'd been doing this thing called opera seria, which is like opera total melodrama. It's all terribly serious, and the English are known for liking comic stuff. There are new opponents for Walpole at court, and one of these is recently returned from the Lowlands, Lord Chesterfield, who sent me down this whole Walpole path ages ago. These new enemies have their contacts in the Commons, and those contacts are now voting non-Walpole. I want us a by-election, and in comes a guy who says, I don't support this excise bullshit. Mate, did you not hear Walpole? He's not proposing an excise anyway. We're not worried about reason, logic, truth or anything, are we? It's politics. Oh, and that's another by-election in Chester, and this time Walpole is taking no chances. Excise officers from all over the country are being sent to work in Chester. Well, when I say work, I mean vote, and because they're unpopular, soldiers from that standing army have been sent in to help them. Sorry, Walpole, not a standing army, it's a land army, isn't it? Yes, totally different thing, isn't it? Yes. Tories will get in a few hundred Welsh ready to pick a fight. All you need say is Richard Manley, who is the Whig candidate, and you will find hairy Welshmen belting you up. The Tory candidate will get 811 votes to Manley's 547, and it's another defeat for Walpole, even though he'd sent all those excise officers in. That's a bit of a rough one. The actual bill has made it to the House, and we're going nuts. Well, sort of. The opposition are calm enough to whip up the mob. That's easy to do. You just tell the mob the government are going to increase your taxes, and the mob will do the rest. Apart from the mob, things have changed at court, as I just said. Chesterfield and the other new anti-Walpolians are whispering to Carolyn and George stuff like, hey, this new excise will put up the price of fags, and the soldiers in that not standing but land army won't be having an increase in the price of fags. It looks like there will be a mutiny. Lord Scarborough will go further, saying, hey, I shall look to get my brave boys to stop any Jacobite bullshit, but I won't be able to stop them if they are shitty about the price of fags. And so it came to pass that pro-excise Walpolean started to feel a strain, and that includes our royal couple. Carolyn was astute enough to know that at the end of the day, she and George were a pair of filthy foreigners. And who better to blame for any unhappiness we feel? Yeah, blame the foreigners. George is keeping an eye on the numbers, and the support team is losing people all the time. It's about the votes, my dear listener. There's all sorts of votes going down with divisions being called so the numbers get counted, and it's going downhill for Walpole. Pulteney will have a good hard think and get the city to put up a petition against the excise proposal. That petition comes in under the same basis as the one that the government refused to read from Rhode Island. So it's a smart move. And the acceptance or non-acceptance of the petition will be debated and the government will win. But this time the vote was 214 to 197 and crikey, it's getting pretty close. The government's majority has halved and halved again. At this point, not only does it look like the end for any excise bill, it looks like the end of the Walpole government. Walpole will be off to see George and Carolyn. When he comes out, he'll tell his close supporters, this dance, it will no farther go. Yes, the opposition have won, the excise bill's rejected, and, or just not rejected, it's just dumped, and oh hooray. Yeah, but the losers may not be gracious losers. Carolyn was upset, George was outraged. He wants a list of names of the peers that failed to support the bill. He will vow to exclude them from court forever. Yeah, just words there. But Walpole will be a bit more direct. 2 days later, and Chesterfield is coming to St. James as usual, but he's a guard with a summons. You, mate, are to surrender your office and piss off from court. Chesterfield will be successful in seeing George. Hey, George, look, I just told you the truth. This bill would have been very unpopular with the mob. I've given you 18 years of good service and do not deserve to be sacked. That'll be tough shit, mate. You're sacked. Piss off.
Since she's been gone, I want no one to talk to me. It's not the same, but I'm to blame, it's plain to see. So go away, leave me alone, don't bother me. I can't believe that she would leave me on my own. It's just alright when every night I'm all alone. I've got no time for you right now, don't bother me.
Yes, thanks Fab for there. Henrietta Howard, though, is no fair weather friend. She'll maintain her friendship with Chesterfield. He will write that her actions are a most uncommon and uncourtlike piece of friendship. Fair call, even though I'm not certain uncourt-like is a proper word. He's talking about it's not like a courtier. Chesterfield will gather plenty of opposition members around while he's in exile. Well, York. That's exile, isn't it? York, north of England. And what are this mob going to do next? Well, work out that Fred, the Prince of Wales, is a bit of a stirrer with the royal couple. The relationship between George II and his lad Fred is looking to be about the same as the relationship George II had with his dad, German George. While George II is boring, Fred has turned out to be affable and cultured. Didn't we get that the same thing? We said that the same thing the last generation, didn't we? Young Fred also likes intrigue, and the opposition can always provide a bit of intrigue. The prince also respected art and culture, so the writer types like him. Henry St. John Bolingbroke will become his mentor, and Fred was instrumental in stirring up trouble over the excise thing. Good time to go immediately back on the attack against Walpole. Let's hit him right in the Septennial Act. We want elections back to triennial every 3 years, thanks. There will be an immediate attack in Parliament, but Walpole has it covered. His speech will win the day, and it will remain 7 years for elections. Speaking of what, 1734 election, oh, what fun. Let's go direct to the results. Yes, we're in the tally room. Whigs, 330, down 85. Tories, 145, up 17. The Patriot Whigs, 83, up 68. Well, there you go. Walpole has had a kick in the nuts but remains in the majority. It's 330 of his guys to a combined Tory and Patriot Whigs, 228. Henrietta is being a friend to the big names in opposition. It's like she's trying to get the sack from a job. Now that she is Lady Suffolk, she'll make new friends too. Hello, Elizabeth Germain, daughter of the second Earl of Berkeley and former lady-in-waiting to Queen Anne. She had married John Germain, Duchy soldier type, and potential illegitimate kiddie to the Prince of Orange. If that was right, then that would have made him a half-brother to our King William III. So these two had three kiddies, but none survived. And now John Germain is dead as well, so poor old Betty's on her own. She is regarded as spirited and intelligent, and therefore good friend material for Henrietta. She also has a brother, George Berkeley, 4 years younger than Henrietta. He was likewise considered to be very intelligent and rather witty. He's an MP and picked up a job thanks to being a Walpolean. But then in came Pulteney with his opposition ideas, and George has turned into an opposition type. George and Pulteney will be into what we might call coarse humour or schoolboy humour. They are so naughty that lots of their letters and writings will be suppressed until the 20th century. It's tame stuff for us, like a poem about a woman who claimed to have given birth to some rabbits. When the local landowner goes to examine her, he reaches under her dress and says, "Sure, I can feel rabbit's fur." Yeah, that's her pubic hair. But you see what I mean? It's pretty tame and not even really that funny in our times. In fact, I don't think it's very funny at all. You could have come up with something better about going down a rabbit hole, boys. George, it seems, was also overly fond of Mrs. Pulteney, which might have been the cause of some tension between George and Pulteney. But apart from his schoolboy humour and staring too long at his mate's missus, he was apparently charming with refined taste. He enjoyed hanging out with the poets and the intellectuals, who are just the sort of people who hang out with Henrietta. There will be correspondence between George and Henrietta, and the correspondence can be more than just writing. Here comes two pieces of china for Henrietta's collection. The decoration on them is the Adam and Eve thingy and the Garden of Eden thingy. Even I can read that one. It says, "Hey, Henrietta, you have successfully tempted me." And there will be an event worth celebrating. September 1733, and dead shit, Charles will leave the planet. I can't say he went to heaven, but he surely is dead, so wahoo for Henrietta. She'd pretty much got rid of him, but he kept on going with the bloody legal stuff contesting his brother's will. The only way to be absolutely, totally, 100% rid of this guy has now happened. And nobody much seemed to have cared. There will be an obituary in the Gentleman's Magazine, as you would expect, because he's an earl. But that's it. There's no other records. Henrietta's son is now the 10th Earl of Suffolk. He inherited a property with even more debt following his dead shit dad Charles's time as owner. Young Henry, though, is smarter than Charles. He's going to marry a brewer's daughter, and all debts will be repaid. Henrietta might have been proud of her son, but there won't be any sort of reconciliation between mum and a boy. But she is free to date men now, so it'll be sure. Come on in, George, and we'll have our very own Garden of Eden. Henrietta's boyfriend will become more and more vocal in his opposition to Walpole. He'll be saying stuff like, "Hey, everyone, it isn't the filthy Jacobites being the problem that causes unhappiness. It's actually the management of our government by those non-Jacobites who are in charge." Big call from George at a time when Walpole and his minions were looking to ramp up the anti-Jacobite stuff once again. George will then be off to Bath for a bit, where he can hang out with his mate Henry St. John Lord Bolingbroke. Henrietta's dead keen to get away from court. It shouldn't be that hard, really. Her being mates with the top opposition people had seen George more and more annoyed with her. That is, King George. He no longer even visits her. Henrietta will ask Caroline for 6 weeks off due to bad health. What she wants to do is go to Bath and see if George would agree to let his mistress off for that long. Caroline will say yes. Perhaps she saw it that if she said no, then we might have had a worse situation with the mistress of the robes refusing the job, and that would be a bad look. Off goes Henrietta, giving the gossip magazines plenty to write about. George will note that her going off for 6 weeks caused more gossips than the sacking of 3 ministers would have. Henrietta's supporters will be saying she left court because she had damp, crappy rooms at St. James's. Henrietta probably doesn't care because she can get to Bath and there's plenty of her friends. It's the place to be at the moment. It's the social hub. Chesterfield even had a house there. Bolingbroke and Alexander Pope are in town. Here's Lord Bathurst, who at one stage was thought to be banging Henrietta. George Berkeley was cool with the whole thing, joking that Bathurst was much younger than himself and consequently much fitter for her purpose. Well, it's holidays and fun, fun, fun for Henrietta. In the morning, you take the waters for about an hour. That is, you sit in the waters. There were 5 public baths operating where common smellies could go and watch their betters being somewhere between elegant and ridiculous while doing their bathing. Then you go back to your lodgings for breakfast, following which you might go to a private concert or a lecture on science or the arts. You get services at the Abbey on Sunday, then off to the coffee houses to read the papers or swap gossip. Afternoons might see us on the promenade taking in the sights, then cards or dancing or entertainments in the evening. Dinners at 4 p.m. with nice rich foods to keep our gout bubbling along. Tuesdays and Fridays will see us at a ball. Henrietta's letters indicate that she is suffering from sensory overload in Bath. It's a social whirlwind and all too much. She would much rather retire at home than be part of the fashionable Bath set. What else can we see from her letters? She has discovered the pit of dissent. The opposition people meet secretly after the bath to chat. How can we bring down Walpole type stuff? But clever Henrietta is headed for scandal. Who else is in Bath? Well, it's Princess Amelia, who loves gossip and is a bit unhappy that her dad has a mistress, Henrietta. Princess Amelia will then turn super sleuth and work out who Henrietta is hanging out with. And it's Bolingbroke, Walpole's archenemy. Amelia will put it about that Bolingbroke and Henrietta were looking to turn George against Walpole. Unlikely, Henrietta just wanted out. But all of Bath will soon be buzzing with this gossip. Time for Henrietta to return to court, and it's a big old political storm. Henrietta had returned on the 30th of October, George's birthday. George who had been in a total rage, will snub Henrietta. She is not invited to his birthday party. Well, this may have gone too far. Sure, Henrietta wants the boot out of court, but she wants it to be a soft kick with a nice pension attached, not some total scandal and booted out in disgrace. She will do the smart thing and ask to see Carolyn, and they will chat for over an hour. Both women will leave a written record of what went down. So I can tell you the bits that are common to both records. Henrietta was looking to clear a name and offer her resignation. Tricky, because we're dealing with royals, and therefore, my dear listener, the bullshit levels have to be very, very high. You see, everybody knows that George has a mistress, Henrietta. Everybody knows it. Even you know it. But nobody can talk about it. It cannot be mentioned, except by podcasters, of course. But not even Henrietta and Carolyn can talk about it. They both have to pretend that it's not happening. So Henrietta can't say, hey, George got the shits with me, his mistress. She will have to talk about George as he is in the public domain. So it's words like, I can't stay in Her Majesty's family because the public see that the King doesn't like me. There, all good because George hadn't invited her to the birthday party and the public knew it. Carolyn will say, hey, kiddo, you are dreaming. Well, actually what she said was, child, you dream. Why, I saw the King speak to you. Henrietta will say, sure, just to get up me, and that was it. He ignored me after that. Carolyn will say, for God's sake, consider your character. You leave me because the King will not be more particular to you than others. Yeah, Carolyn's pushing it here, so Henrietta will have to admit that George no longer visits her apartment. One up for Carolyn, but Henrietta will be on about it being a platonic relationship. The King was dearer to me than my own brother type of stuff. It's all very sad to lose his friendship. Carolyn will say, oh, come on, this is a lover's tiff. You read too many romance novels. Oh, all right, says Henrietta. If the gloves are coming off, then what exactly have I done wrong? It must be terrible for me to be treated so badly. Henrietta will get rather agitated while Carolyn keeps her cool. Henrietta will go back to her objective. She wants to retire from court. Carolyn will say, if you leave court, you'll become a nobody. You won't have any friends at all. Henrietta will now be rather clever, saying, well, my friends tell me that it's the courtier in me they don't like, not me. So if you think that argument's going to tempt me to stay, well, that would be wrong. Carolyn has lost that rather big point, so will say, well, if you leave today, it'll be without consent. Yeah, well, that means, you know, no pension, no nothing. How about you just think about it for a week, and if you still want to leave at the end of the week, okay. Sure, says Henrietta, but given that George is being so hostile, I want to stay away from work. That will be a no from Carolyn. I want you at work, Missy, and lay off the romance novels.
Bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping, out on the streets the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way.
Yes, Dolly Parton doesn't know it. She is lucky. If you're a lady to the Queen, then you're going to have to work 24/7. It's shit for Henrietta. And they have to work 24/7 because these royals are pretty useless, aren't they? Like Charles III has somebody coming in to iron his shoelaces. Now, if he can't iron his own fucking shoelaces, is he fit to be king? That's what I'm asking. Is he fit? Like, ironing your own shoelaces. Not that hard, Charles. Henrietta had no interest in changing her mind, though. She wants to be off. But she did want to restore some sort of relationship with George. She'd go to find him walking in the gardens, but he wasn't interested in talking to her at all. Henrietta then will write to him. There's two drafts of the letter that remain, but the original didn't survive. It spoke about their intimate relationship, the one we can never admit happened. I ask, sir, but what your meanest to your guiltiest subject can claim. Oh, well done. She's going for the I'm innocent until proven guilty thing, and Henrietta hasn't even been charged with anything, let alone proven guilty. Then it's on about how happy George had made her and how grateful Henrietta is to him. And, oh, look, okay, if it's over, then it's over. But if I've got to go through the pain of forgetting you as my dear friend, nothing will ever make me forget you as my magnificent king. Oh, boo-hoo-hoo, ladies and gentlemen. Not. George gives zero fucks. Carolyn will tell George, I tried to make a stay, and George will say, what the devil did you mean by trying to make an old, dull, deaf, peevish beast stay and play me when I had so good an opportunity of getting rid of her? Oh, he's nasty, isn't he? Ladies, he's a nasty man. Henrietta is gone, and Carolyn will say, you know, lots of people told me how sensible she is, but I never saw her take a sensible step. Going away from court was the silliest thing she did. But that's it, she's gone, and it'll be a scandal. All the gossip magazines are running the story. Some of them have it as cruel George, who had kept her as a slave for 20 years, and now she's sacrificed her time, her quiet, her reputation, her health, her youth, to his service and pleasure. She has been cast aside. Others say he was right to ditch the witch, a mistress who was nothing but trouble. The big speculation, though, was on what caused the split. And there's plenty of theories. One looks to be the right one, and that is that dead shit Charles died and Henrietta wanted to have time to herself now. Henrietta's friends will stand by her. She was absolutely spot on when she told Carolyn being a courtier did absolutely nothing for her friendships. In fact, her friends celebrated with her. You can see from her letters, though, that some of her friends may not have known her that well. They worry that Henrietta must be devastated at losing her place at court. Oh, no, you've moved out of the sunshine that is the court to the shadows of privacy and retirement. Yeah, look, my dear listener, the shadows of privacy and retirement isn't a bad place to be. Other letters say stuff like, I heartily wish you may make yourself easy, though I know it must be a hard struggle. Yeah, no, there's no hard struggle here. Henrietta's going great. She loves it. As for the gossip, well, today's news is tomorrow's fish and chips wrapper. That's an olden days saying, my dear listener. Back there in the 60s and 70s, you could always drop your newspaper off at the fish and chip shop once you'd read it, and they would recycle your newspaper by using the pages to wrap up the fish and chips. Anyway, the saying tends to work, and sure enough, people find other things to talk about after a couple of days, and Henrietta leaving the court is old news, who cares, move on. Perhaps, though, Carolyn will remember, because now she has got to spend more time with George. Oh, no. Princess Anne, likewise, will be copping more time with Dad. Oh, no. She'll tell Lord Harvey she certainly hopes George finds a new mistress nice and bloody quick, and that Carolyn in particular would benefit from less George. Henrietta's replacement, then, is Camilla, Countess Tankerville. Yeah. Maybe not for long. Professional airhead who had George flirting with her previously, so we've all got our fingers crossed that George will get his dick into her. I called her an airhead, they called her a very safe fool. Our airhead won't be trying any political stuff with George, and this was actually Walpole and Carolyn. They were manoeuvring Camilla to put her in with George because they thought they could control her. Oh, too late, Wally. George has spotted his daughter's governess, Lady Deloraine. Not described as a safe fool, this one, no. She is described as vivacious and attractive, with a pretty face, a lying tongue, and a false heart. Oh, Wally and Carolyn are worried. Tough shit, because George is besotted, and before you know, he's boasting that he had her on his daughter's bed. Oh, that's getting a bit weird. George banging some girl on your daughter's bed. Get yourself a hotel room. Oh dear, why ever did Carolyn let Henrietta get away? Much regret for Carolyn and zero regret for Henrietta. And look, my dear listener, Lady Deloraine won't last. I'll give you a hint there. Henrietta is at a house in Marble Hill, fluffing around and getting every little detail just right. Nice paintings to be hung, gilded sculptures to be placed, finely carved furniture around the house, all that sort of stuff. It's all got to be set up. But, oh, what's this? Portraits of some Stuarts. Dear me. Has she turned Jacobite? Oh. It's all set up now, the house, so it's time to entertain friends. Henrietta's health will improve. Carolyn's health will not improve. Henrietta is enjoying a house so much, she's decided to buy another one. A nice space in town would be good, so it'll be Savile Street. These days, Savile Row. Just north of Piccadilly and very fashionable. Savile Street was a new development undertaken by the Earl of Burlington. He had built a house in Piccadilly, which is now the Royal Academy of Arts. Then he went to work in the area just north of that house. Savile Street was named after his missus, Lady Dorothy Savile, and before you know it, fashionable houses are going up for elite society types. Builders Gray and Fortnum will offer a house in an unfinished state in 1735 for just £2,500. Bargain, so Henrietta will say, where do I sign? This place included an adjoining coach house for three horses. Henrietta will get in the same builders who did Marble Hill for her. The place will have a flushing dunny with a seat for men to leave up. Henrietta will be totally involved and knows exactly what she wants. The painting of the place had just been done when she bought it, but no, she's going to have painters back in because she wasn't happy with the job. Now, where is the money coming from? Well, George gave her an annual pension of £2,000, and she had gotten a substantial termination payment. We do not want a tell-all book being published, so a big whack of money will sort that out. Now, I don't know for sure, but I understand it might have been £80,000. The work can be completed on the new house, and Henrietta can open up a townhouse to her friends who all go, oh, wow, she's got the best of everything in there. A widow having two houses is going to seem a bit excessive. A widow is supposed to live happily alone in just one mansion or move in with friends who have a big old place. But perhaps she's not intending to remain a widow. It's been 2 years since Deadshit Charles died and George Berkeley is a frequent flyer to Henrietta's house. Henrietta and George will astonish their friends when they announce, hey, we got married in St. Dunstan's Church. That's St. Dunstan's, on the Berkeley family estate. There was a quiet little wedding ceremony. Henrietta is back in the gossip magazines, of course, with speculation and unhappy remarks. Whatever is Henrietta doing, the silly girl? He is neither young, handsome, healthy, or rich. But, oh, she's getting on in years too, so couldn't be too picky and snapped up the first bloke that came along. No, it was just to prove that she hadn't been the king's mistress. No, it was just to annoy her ditched lover, the king. Yeah. No, look, she's in love. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, she's in love. Isn't that lovely? George, too, was surprised, but okay with it. Carolyn thought Henrietta was being silly. Does Henrietta care about them? No, she's in love. And there you go. Not good-looking, nor young, nor rich George was. Cultured, witty, sincere, good-natured and mild-mannered. Not a bad boy like Deadshit Charles. All Henrietta's friends are very happy for her, and all George's friends were very happy for him. Well, there's got to be an exception, of course, so meet Teresa Blount, and I seriously wish I could go down a rabbit hole to tell you this girl's story. Or, in fact, it's Teresa and her sister Martha, who were both friends with Alexander Pope. Really, though, there's probably no threesome there for me to find. And I think if we time-travelled, we'd find that bullshitty Georgian stuff going on, like what you see in Bridgerton. Nobody much telling the truth. We all dance around things without saying them out loud. Anyway, I can't tell you about Teresa Blount because I don't really know the story. But she'll write to Pope about Henrietta and George. To behold the happy pair, and at night to see her deaf-eared and his lame leg put into bed on purpose, bought for the unexpected nuptials. Yes, well, Therese, neither you nor Martha managed to get a man, did you? Even though you were both rather cute, so I don't know what's going on there. Teresa will tell Pope that Henrietta and George did, though, seem very happy in the marriage, even though she'd bagged them just before. Teresa is correct. Our couple are very happy with a relationship built on mutual affection, esteem and respect. They will be totally happy entertaining visitors at Marble Hill, and it is they who get the best people in the arts and sciences, not George and Carolyn. All we need are a couple of kiddies, but Henrietta's baby-making gear is closed for business a few years ago. No worries. Henrietta's brother John has his son and daughter who will move in, and George and Henrietta can have a fine time parenting this pair. Their dad, John Hobart, will visit frequently, and the kiddies likewise will go home on a frequent basis. Henrietta can also have more fun fiddling about to turn Marble Hill now into a family home. She'll employ another servant to help out. Henrietta, though, will cop the headaches again. Lord Cobham will write saying, "Hey, come and visit my famous gardens at Stowe and have a nice rest." Henrietta will go, but only for a few days. The letters between Henrietta and George say that neither can bear to be parted from the other. Henrietta will be back ahead of time and seems fully recovered. Having joined back up with George, they will each vow to the other never to be parted again. Nor will they be parted again. I think we may park them there for a while, enjoying the domestic bliss, and well done, Henrietta. Novel Oath Undo Me by Megan Formanek, who is an Australian author, and she claims to be a historian who is interested in the Scandinavian mob that we like to call the Vikings. So her character is female. It's about this female from Sweden who wants to be a shield maiden, but we don't actually get that. We get her becoming more involved in business and commerce. So the author's looking to explore that Viking culture where it's more than just a bunch of hairy guys turning up looking to kill you. It's when they're with their own people, of course, they're just normal everyday people. I have to say the book didn't quite do it for me. There was a time there where our main character Astrid wanders on into a Christian church without killing anybody, sadly. But she has a chat to a priest, and the priest is talking in Latin, and I'm thinking, well, yeah, no, not really. It was a little bit slow for me, but there you go. If you're interested in reading a book about a Scandinavian woman looking to make it on her own, Oath Undo Me by Megan Formanek. But for us, it's just a matter of what we're going out with. It's always lovely to see some creative person coming up with something. And this would be Angel Lakita, who's come up with a little thing called One Margarita, which she got from a weird-looking woman who was saying what would happen to a woman if you gave her one margarita. Oh, I think I've confused that nicely. So we're going out with One Margarita by Angel Lakita. Hope to see you next week. Bye. Give me one margarita, I'ma open my leg. Give me two margaritas, I'ma give you some head. Give me three margaritas, I'ma put it in my puss. Give me four margaritas, I'ma put it in my tush. Give me five margaritas, I'ma get some fun. Give me five margaritas, I'ma put it in your bun. Give me one margarita, I'ma open my leg. Give me two margaritas, I'ma give you some head. Give me three margaritas, I'ma put it in my puss. Give me four margaritas, I'ma put it in my tush. Give me five margaritas, give me five margaritas, give me one margarita, two margaritas, give me three margaritas, margaritas. Come on, bro. What is he doing? You need to give me one margarita, two margaritas, give me three margaritas, margaritas. Going out with my baby and I'm trying to get him. Wanna give my man something that he'll never.